I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The long, often passionate affair between Ralph Nader and the political left seems to be ending badly, as millions of Democrats fume about Nader's decision to again run for president. Democrats remember the 2000 election when, in Florida, for example, if even 1% of voters for Nader had cast their ballots instead for Gore, President Al Gore would currently be running for re-election. On NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, moderator Tim Russert asked if Nader was a spoiler on an ego trip.
A spoiler is a contemptuous term, as if anybody who dares to challenge the two-party system, corrupt politics and broken politics and corporate power, is a spoiler. Come again.
We're joined by Doug Hadaway, who was Al Gore's press spokesperson back in 2000. Doug, welcome.
Good to be here.
Doug, even many who followed the 2000 campaign thought you'd be the press spokesperson in a Gore administration, which would have been pretty heady stuff daily from the White House. But as a person, too, I'm wondering what you make of Nader's decision to run.
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious, particularly since he got less than 3% of the national vote last time, that this is just about Ralph Nader. He's going to use this as a media vehicle to promote his books and his speeches on the college campus circuit, I suppose. But I don't think anybody's going to be fooled by any sense that Ralph Nader is actually making a challenge to the two-party system.
Yeah, but gee, Doug, the passion that he put out on Meet the Press yesterday seemed real enough, railing against corporate influence over politics. He presented himself as someone who just had to tilt against windmills because he felt so strongly about a co-opted political process. That's all show?
Yeah, this is the same guy in 2000 who said there was no difference between Al Gore and George Bush, which was nothing short of a lie, and I just don't think that people are going to buy that sort of line now. And what we found in 2000 was that people who were considering to vote for Nader really cared about things like protecting the environment and freedom of choice, particularly. And, of course, anybody who cares about those issues now knows that Bush is an absolute disaster on both fronts.
Yeah, there's a record out there now. That's the difference?
Exactly. I think in 2000, there was virtually an issueless election, if you will. The economy seemed to be doing fine. We hadn't been attacked by terrorists, and there was a lot of ambivalence about the two guys running for office, but no big issues, really, that were dominating things. And a protest vote didn't seem like it was all that dangerous, if you will, at the time. Well, it's pretty clear now that it's not a protest vote. It's a vote for George Bush and for more of the kind of government that he's brought. And I don't think Nader's really going to be able to pull even the kind of votes he did last time. That said, it's going to be another close election, and having a candidate on the ballot, and certainly in some particularly close states, having a candidate pulling votes from the left is going to be another advantage for Bush.
How dangerous an advantage?
It really depends on the state. I mean, if you look at what's happening now as we begin the election year, Bush enters the race with pretty much every conceivable advantage except two. He's got the bully pulpit of the White House. He's got more money than anyone's ever raised for president. He's got the convention later in the cycle, which gives him the advantage of a post-convention bounce. And having a third-party candidate drawing votes in, you know, a state like Oregon, perhaps, or some of these marginal states that were really, really close last time could leave him with yet one more advantage. Like I say, he's got every advantage but two, and the two he doesn't have is his record and his own candidacy. Bush has really got a really bad record on the economy and on security since he's taken office, and that gives our side plenty to work with.
Doug, you know Democratic political circles. Is there anybody out there that has a sense that he could bring a movement up? He says, Nader does, that he'll raise more than the $8 million he did last time. For example, could disgruntled Deniacs go for Nader? What are people saying in Democratic circles?
Perhaps. Howard Dean himself called on his supporters not to support Nader, but to unite behind the Democrats. And I think that is one thing that's very different in this cycle. The Democrats and progressives are really united like never before, and they've been united by George Bush. So I think they'll have trouble, in fact, raising the money he raised before. There's just too much at stake here to throw away another election on Ralph Nader.
Democratic strategist and former Gore spokesperson, Doug Hadaway. Doug, thanks very much.
Thank you.
The number of minority applicants to the University of Michigan is significantly down. It's been 8 months since the Supreme Court struck down the school's undergraduate admission formula, a point system which used race as one factor. And at last count, the number of Black, Hispanic, and American Indian applicants was down 23% from this same time last year. Joining us on the line is Ted Spencer, Director of Admissions at the University of Michigan. And Ted, what do you think has happened here? Is it possible that potential minority students have the impression that they're not welcome at your school, that they think, as many people do, that the Supreme Court ruling actually threw out affirmative action completely, which is not what happened?
No, well, it didn't throw it out at all. In fact, the court's ruling allows us to continue to use race as one of many factors in our admission process. And so I think that part of the problem is that there's been a lot of information around the case and surrounding the language of the case. And I think that for some reason it's had somewhat of a chilling effect on some of the students who are applying. But then again, it may just be that this year, in terms of students who are applying to places like Michigan, that the numbers are just down. I'm not sure what the reasons, whether the reasons are just specific to Michigan or if there are reasons that are much broader.
Well, for instance, the economy, I would imagine, would be one.
Exactly. I'm sure that the economy, I think that the further students are away from a school, I think travel has been somewhat of a burden in many cases, just the idea of having to go through a lot of the security checks. And
well, in fact, your office says in a paper considering a lot of these issues that perhaps minority students are still coming from families in which they're the first student to go to college, so the application process is confusing. Families may not want to fly to visit schools, which is a ritual in other families who have been doing it for several generations. Do you think that's still true of minority students?
Well, it's a generalization, and I want to not generalize too much, but I think that in some cases that's a factor. But I think that also just the hostile language that surrounds even this proposal, this Ward Connolly's proposal, that kind of language has a chilling effect perhaps on some families that might be thinking about Michigan and hearing that there may be some referendum, that maybe they just don't want to be involved or be at a place where those kind of things are going on. And so it's our job to make certain that we let them know that we really do want them to come to Michigan, and the court has really given us an opportunity to increase our diversity on our campus.
You mentioned this initiative. This is the proposed ballot initiative on affirmative action.
Yes, that's right. They're trying to get signatures now for this year's election, during the presidential election. They need some 300,000 signatures and in order for it to become a ballot proposal. And, of course, there's been a great deal written about that in the newspapers, at least in the area. And so I think that in some ways that may also be a factor.
Right. Well, Ted Spencer, thank you.
Thank you.
Ted Spencer is Director of Undergraduate Admissions at the University of Michigan. He spoke to us from Chicago. We turn now to India, which has one of the most aggressive quota systems in the world and maybe one of the oldest. Affirmative action is considered a right in India. It's written into the Constitution and has been in place for over half a century. Joining us on the line is Martha Ann Oberland. She's a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Martha, you've written about India's quota system. It feels as if there's a quota for everyone in that country.
Well, there actually is, but it's taken about 50 years, as you said, to develop to that situation. It originally started to benefit just the untouchables and also the tribals. India has a large numbers of what they call their indigenous people. They give them a 7.5% reservation or quota, and they give the untouchables or Dalits, as they call them now, 15% reservation.
And we should say the Dalits are, as you said, the untouchables. They're relegated to getting rid of human waste in small towns. They are the ones who get rid of animal carcasses.
Well, historically, and this has been going on for thousands of years, like the caste system has been in place, untouchables have been those who literally perform the polluting tasks in Hinduism. And that, as you said, would be just getting rid of animal carcasses, skinning animals, and also getting rid of human waste. Those tasks, despite modernity, still exist in India. And, you know, it depends on who you talk to. There are tens of millions of Indians that still perform those tasks every day. So in some ways, you know, India has moved into the 21st century. In other ways, it's still back in the 18th and 19th century when it comes to those tasks. And those prejudices still exist.
Mm-hmm. But as you write, the quota system has now evolved so that there are seats reserved for descendants of those who fought to oust the British, children of parents who died while battling to save the Tamil language, the children of farmers who developed crops. The list goes on and on.
What happened over the years is that when certain groups saw the benefits that they could get by having those reservations or those quotas, they suddenly started to clamor for their own, which makes sense. And the way that the politics and the history developed was that the politicians gave into those demands, of course, because then they would get reelected. So over the years, people clamored for their own reservations. So as you said, the children of fishermen, the children of people who died in military battles, the army heroes, they were given their own reservations too. Mm. So in some states, and Rajasthan is one of those states, over 80% of the people in that state qualify for some kind of reservation or quota. So it's gotten out of control.
And as you say, some of the members of the so-called upper class feel that these reservations are just politicians' way of building up a voting bank, and that, in fact, members of the so-called lower castes don't really take advantage of the reservations.
Well, it's difficult when it comes to higher education for places that are reserved in college, because if you weren't able to go to a primary school because you were too poor, or you weren't able to get private coaching classes to get you into a good high school and then on to a college, there's no way you could take advantage of going to college in the first place.
Do you see the quota system, though, staying as it is for at least the foreseeable future?
Absolutely. When I did this story interviewing people who were untouchables, who were Brahmins, they may have criticized the system, but no one wanted to get rid of it. What they wanted was to get their own reservation. So people who are the upper caste, the people who historically had all the benefits in society, they now want their own quotas for their children. So in other words, it's like giving the Rockefellers or the Kennedys a quota system because they have money, but they aren't that smart and they can't get into college. So it's gotten out of control, and everyone realizes that, but no one wants to be the first person to say, listen, you know, our group has benefited, you know, a great deal. We'll step back while the other, you know, oppressed groups get ahead.
Martha Ann Overland, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Martha Ann is a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. She spoke to us from Hanoi in Vietnam.
Just ahead, we begin a series on milk. How do you know what's behind the label? Follow it back to the farm.
And later, the UN now says elections could take place in Iraq by the end of the year. But what is the state of that nation? We'll speak to a member of the governing council in Baghdad.
There's more coming up here and now.
Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
It's been said that the world divides roughly into people who don't have enough food and those who have too much. Many Americans, of course, fall into the latter category. Yet with mad cow and avian flu in the news, it seems that supermarket shoppers are increasingly interested, even anxious, about the origins of their food.
The biggest issues for me would be additives that get added in the process.
The bird flu and genetically modified stuff and aspartame.
Just this morning I was talking with a girlfriend about how easy it was for my mother or when I first started cooking. Like nowadays, like I would only buy ground meat in one of these specialty sections.
I hear that they put a lot of antibiotics and growth hormones and other stuff, you know, that might decrease its nutrition value.
We don't eat beef, any beef, because of mad cow, because of all the down cows. I would eat it in other countries, but not here.
I'm concerned about the pesticides that remain on my fruits and vegetables, even after I wash them. I'm much more leery of eating farm-raised fish, and I buy a lot more organic foods.
So this week, we'll take an in-depth look at a single product, one that's symbolic for some of health and safety, milk. We begin with Here and Now producer Alan Cockle and a journey behind the label.
Ah, decisions, decisions. Things were bad enough when it was just 2% whole or skim milk in the dairy aisle. But today there are at least half a dozen brands and a range of prices. Do you want conventional milk? Growth hormone free? And what about organic? Here, this looks promising.
3.69.
The milk we've settled on is the Organic Cow of Vermont brand. And the side of the carton tells quite a story, beginning with the founding of the company in Tunbridge, Vermont in 1990.
Please take your items.
And it's true. Organic Cow of Vermont began with just one farm when owners Peter and Bunny Flint decided to switch from conventional to organic production.
The biggest consideration was the health of the cows. They reduced stress by not pushing the cows for increased production because you get a sustainable price for the milk so that you don't have to use hormones in order for the cows to make milk.
Peter Flint says that despite the higher price, demand for the Organic Cow of Vermont was strong, and the Flints soon started buying milk from neighboring farmers. The carton tells us that the milk now comes from Vermont, Maine, New York, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Michigan. But the overall impression is still one of, well, a local product. The carton tells, for instance, about one of the Organic Cow of Vermont producers, a man named Rob Howe. It describes his small Vermont farm and his favorite cow named Babe. Babe sure knows how to turn on the charm, the carton says. By batting her big, beautiful eyes, Babe is the perfect example of how big blessings sometimes come in small packages.
I'm Rob Howe. I live in Tunbridge, Vermont. We have a organic, certified organic dairy farm, milk around 35 to 40 cows. We have
And Rob Howe's farm, with its 100-year-old barn perched on a steep Vermont hillside, looks every bit as idyllic as the carton makes it sound. Rob became an organic farmer in 1995, attracted by the premium price he'd get for his milk and by the idea of selling milk to his neighbors.
I really wanted to sell to a small company. And I was sick of selling to the large companies where you're only a number and your milk goes on the truck with milk from thousands of other cows and you have no product out there that you can say, hey, that's something that I helped to produce.
But what the quaint portrait on the side of the carton leaves out is the rest of the story of the Organic Cow of Vermont. The company grew so quickly that the Flints sold a controlling interest to the big H.P. Hood Dairy Company in 1997. And a few years later, Hood and the Flints sold again, this time to the Horizon Organic Dairy Company of Colorado. Horizon is the $240 million giant of the organic industry. And while the fine print on the carton does mention Horizon, the company's name appears nowhere on the Organic Cow of Vermont website. Gwen Shearer is Horizon's director of marketing.
Horizon Organic works with over 300 farmer partners across the United States, and over 140 of those farms are in the Northeast. We've got family farms that we work with to produce our organic milk in Pennsylvania, Vermont, Maine, and New York. They range in size from 12 cattle to 1,500 cattle.
Organic Cow of Vermont milk is ultra-pasteurized, heated to a much higher temperature than normal pasteurization to give the milk a 60-day shelf life. That lets the company ship milk over long distances. For instance, this carton, which was purchased in Boston, carries a stamp that identifies it as coming from an H.P. Hood processing plant in Oneida, New York. Despite all this, Gwen Shearer doesn't think there's anything misleading about the marketing of the milk.
Horizon Organic and the Organic Cow Vermont have very much tried to stay true to their small company origins and true to the philosophies and beliefs of organic production. I would also say, though, that we really do believe that when it comes to organic, bigger is sometimes better because it means more acres of agriculture converted to organic and more support for a growing organic industry.
Supermarket chains sell a lot of milk, so for a company to sell to these stores, they have to produce a lot of milk. Some stores charge the producer a fee to stock their product, and Peter Flint, the founder of Organic Cow of Vermont, says whoever has the money gets the shelf space.
You know, we were going to market the milk from our own cows, and And we did that. But as the demand grew, either we needed to grow with it or we were going to lose our slice of the pie.
People buy organic produce for a lot of reasons. For most people, perceptions of food safety or environmental benefits are probably the main reason. Though to judge by the packaging, a local, folksy image is also part of it. But as we've seen, that image doesn't always match the reality. And earlier this year, Horizon Organics was acquired by Dean Foods, the biggest supplier of liquid milk in the United States, a company with $9 billion in annual sales. And as for Rob Howe, the Vermont farmer, well, he no longer sells milk to the organic cow. He stopped last year. And Babe? Rob Howe's favorite cow that we read about on the side of the carton?
Babe is no longer with us. She's gone to Babe heaven, I guess.
The brown-eyed beauty has long since been turned to ground beef.
We'll continue our milk series tomorrow when producer Alan Cockle compares two dairy farms, one conventional and one organic.
There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A suicide bomber killed at least 7 Iraqis and wounded 35 others outside a police station in the northern Iraq city of Kirkuk this morning. Despite continuing violence, Iraq is moving quickly toward the June 30th deadline for the Coalition Provisional Authority to hand over power to an Iraqi government, though the shape of that government is not yet clear. The influential Shiite cleric Ayatollah Ali Sistani had called for direct elections before June 30th. But last week, the United Nations envoy to Iraq expressed his view that elections by that time were not possible, a view shared by the United States. Today, the UN envoy said he does believe a vote could be possible by late this year, a forecast that's more optimistic than many expected. Last week, we spoke with Muwaffaq al-Rubai'i. He's a Shiite Muslim who's close to the Ayatollah Ali Sistani. He's also a member of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council. Welcome, Mr. Rubai'i.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Rubai'i, does Ayatollah Ali Sistani, in compromising on his call for direct elections sooner rather than later, want something for that?
Well, he's a very realistic man, and he's a practical person. When a United Nations or Kofi Annan would come back and say we cannot hold election before the 30th of June, we would like to ask Kofi Annan, what is the justification behind this decision? Is it technical? Is it security? Is it political reasons? What is it? And also we would like to have a fixed date cast in stone. When can we hold election in Iraq? The second important thing is that who are we going to hand over the sovereignty to?
Now, what do you think this caretaker interim government will, what form will it take, do you think? We hear that it may simply be an expansion of the present governing council. Is that what, how you understand it?
Well, there are three options, if you like. Option number one is leave well alone. Leave the GC as it is, because it gives the continuity, it has some legitimacy from the United Nations Security Council and recognized by the Arab League, and so on and so forth. Now, this is one option.
Mm-hmm.
Option number two is to reduce the governing council, or option number three is to expand the governing council.
Now, most everyone agrees that sooner or later there need to be direct elections, one man, one vote in Iraq. How concerned are you, though, that given that Shiites make up 60% of the country, that if they overwhelm Sunnis and Kurds in a general election, that might cause problems?
I don't think for a minute that the Shia is a homogeneous society. Hmm. The Shia can vote for a communist candidate, for an Islamist candidate, for a secular candidate, for a moderate candidate, and the Shia can vote for a moderate Sunni as well as for a moderate Kurd. And the Kurds themselves, they're Sunni and Shias. So I think this fear, if you like, or this concern is unfounded. And I think it's been overplayed and been exaggerated.
Mr. Rubai, violence continues in Iraq, of course, insecurity, enormous unemployment. What is your sense of the state of the nation right now?
Well, the security can be looked at in two different ways. Mm-hmm. One is the social security. Now, the ordinary crimes like killing, murder, kidnapping and trafficking and all this. Now, this is definitely is on the reducing side. This is decreasing by the day. And the sense of security among the ordinary citizens is much higher, and it's improving by the day. Life is coming back to normal, if you like. The traffic in Baghdad is humongous. Mm-hmm. The shops are opening until late hours at night in Baghdad and in the other cities. So I agree with you. The security, if you look at it from a political, the politically motivated act of terrorism is getting more sophisticated. This is not going to be to go away in the next few weeks, I can tell you that. I think this is going to stay with us for probably months or even years.
What do you think the average Iraqi feels at this point about the governing council of which you are a part, given that many members of the governing council spent many years in exile, many are considered to be part of the elite in Iraq?
I believe, well, first of all, as a statistics, more than half of the governing council members are inpatriate as opposed to expatriate.
Mm-hmm.
This is number one. Number two, these people understand, the expatriate understand democracy. And they have been in the country for almost a year now.
Right.
When are we going to stop calling them expatriate and inpatriate? This is number one. Number two, I think the popularity of the governing council is gathering pace. And I believe one of the opinion polls showed that the popularity in the region of 65 to 70 among ordinary Iraqi citizens. Adding to this, we don't have the full authority. We don't have the full sovereignty. We cannot sign the check. It's the CPA which has the check to sign. So we cannot provide basic services to the people.
How dangerous is the inevitable difficulty after what Iraqis have been through of an economy still struggling to find something for people to do? We hear of figures like 60% unemployment. How concerned are you as an Iraqi about resolving that problem?
I'm very concerned on this. I'm very concerned on the services, basic services, electricity, clean water, telephone service, these basic services, unemployment. And we are waiting with unabated breath, if you like, for the money from the donor's country, for the money from the United States of America to get to Iraq, to stimulate the economy, to get the economy going. And the only way to combat quickly the unemployment is by massive reconstruction campaign, building roads, building houses, building bridges. This is the way to get to get the unemployment or employment going.
What is your vision in Iraq? What do you think you will see in Iraq a year from now?
I think in a few years' time from now, we will look back and say, George W. Bush has done a brilliant job, absolutely marvelous job in this country. He liberated the 25 million Iraqis. We are going to build in this country the Japan of the Middle East. We are going to be the beacon of democracy, the example of democracy in the Middle East. And this is, fortunately, it's a very catching disease, democracy, and it will catch in the rest of the region.
Muwafaq al-Rubai joined us from Baghdad. Mr. Rubai, thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed for having me.
Muwafaq al-Rubai is a Shiite member of Iraq's governing council.
Still to come, older folk music stars, young-sized by their labels, find sweet revenge on indie labels.
And thoughts on the end of Sex in the City?
You're listening to Here and Now. A New York Times cover story today visits the town of Boone, North Carolina, nestled in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and apparently deeply involved in methamphetamine production. In the last 2 years, 41 illegal mom-and-pop methamphetamine labs have been closed, and 17 children taken from those home labs and put in foster homes. But those kids may already have been gravely affected. A new report says that children who live in homes with meth labs may face as dire a risk from the drug as those who actually use it. Well, joining us on the line from Boone is Dr. Andrew Mason, a forensic toxicologist. Doctor, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Doctor, these statistics are mind-boggling. We read that in neighboring Tennessee, 697 children were removed from homes with meth labs in a year-and-a-half time. We know that these labs blow up. One in every five is discovered because there's an explosion. But what is the other danger to children? We're reading about how they get contaminated by the fumes of cooking methamphetamines?
Sure. It's an intensely hazardous process. The way that they're doing it, it's essentially uncontrolled. There are a large number of materials that are produced that have relatively high toxicity. And, of course, children, because they're different than adults, they are at increased risk from exposure to some of these materials.
You understand that kids in your local schools there were getting headaches and were getting sick, and it was discovered that these labs were in their homes. And in their homes, in really obscene ways. I mean, some of the stuff was right in the kitchen sink.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, these folks are not being exactly all that careful about where and how they do this. The kids with the headaches, et cetera, those were kids that were removed directly from the homes and, of course, carried some of that material out of those homes when they went to school.
And we understand that police are now understanding that these children, when they are taken from the homes, they have to be decontaminated?
Yeah, we have a protocol as part of our drug endangered child program here in the county. And this is, of course, in an attempt to protect the health not only of the children, but of people in the emergency room, the doctors, the nurses, the other caregivers, et cetera.
Because these kids are carrying the fumes and the residue from the toxins is actually on their clothing and on their toys.
On their clothing or on their bodies. There are numerous cases in the literature that I've seen where individuals present to emergency rooms and then they contaminate the scene, the doctors, the nurses, et cetera, some of them have become quite ill from exposure to these materials.
Doctor, why do you think that there are so many labs?
There are two points. It's a matter of economic incentive. It's also a matter of the fact that this material is extremely addictive. People are both producing it for personal use as well as selling it. It's quite lucrative.
And it's cheap to make.
And it's very cheap to make. The materials are very, very available.
Well, we read that 8,000 illegal methamphetamine labs have been seized across the country. Oh, well over 3,000 kids were taken out of homes in those labs. What's been the reaction in Boone to this problem that, you know, used to be somewhere else, suddenly being right in your living rooms?
Well, that's a great point. We never were concerned about it until very recently, and then all of a sudden it's been a major problem. We've actually had great support. The community has really come together and mobilized all of our resources on this problem. We've had great community support. There's not a single agency that you can't think of that hasn't made a contribution to this process. We've been successful in fighting it here, and especially dealing with kids, because we have an integrated and coordinated response to this problem. And if other communities are going to fight it successfully, that's how they're going to have to do it.
Well, Doctor, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Dr. Andrew Mason, forensic toxicologist in the town of Boone, North Carolina.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Major music labels over the past few years have been aggressively young-sizing, getting rid of older stars. But instead of fading away, many of those stars are enjoying revived careers on independent record labels. There's Dolly Parton, Charlie Daniels, Nancy Griffith, Judy Collins. Both Johnny and June Carter Cash made their final records on indie labels. Both won Grammys posthumously this year. Well, here in our folk critic, Scott Alaric has brought in a few indie CDs he says are worth a listen. But, Scott, you also say this is really affecting the labels that you cover.
It really is. Folk music is, I think, historically positioned to benefit from this kind of young sizing. And it's also a genre that is almost by definition indifferent to things like age and demographics. A perfect example is Dolly Parton, who's now really having a tremendous renaissance on the hip bluegrass label Sugar Hill.
Well, wait a minute. Dolly Parton, I can't believe, because what you're saying, going back to the whole young sizing, is she couldn't get on a major label?
Isn't it incredible? You'd think that wherever the bar is for commercial viability, you should be automatically above it if you have your own theme park.
It should be
a gimme. But they can't get her on commercial radio. They can't do anything with her. So she's landed at Sugar Hill, and it's part of the reason that Sugar Hill is doing the best business of its history at a time when many of the majors are just teetering on the brink of extinction.
And at her age, and with all that she deserves at that age, she's getting full attention, I imagine, from a smaller label.
Another one of the characteristics of these folk indies is they believe deeply in letting the artist control their own music and their own career. Here's an example from what I think is the best of the Sugar Hill CDs she's made, called Little Sparrow. It's the title cut, and it really shows how crucially Parton was able to bridge the gap between Southern Mountain traditional music, which is the root of country music, and modern pop songwriting.
I am not a little sparrow. I am just the broken dream of a cold, false-hearted lover and his evil, cunning scheme. Little sparrow, precious friend.
Well, I want to hear another example, another artist and another label.
Well, there's Rounder, which is the largest of the folk indie labels in this country. They recently picked up Nancy Griffith, who had been on major labels for a long time after beginning her career on Rounder. And there's also the Kendalls, sort of the quintessential commercial country hitmakers of the 70s and 80s, a father and son duo that had huge hits with songs like, boy, does this sound like country music, what, Heaven's Just a Sin Away, You'd Make an Angel Want to Cheat, and Thank God for the Radio. But soon the country labels didn't want to have anything to do with them anymore. And in the 90s, they began talking with Rounder. But before they could release a record, the father, Royce Kendall, died. His daughter, Jeannie, needed a few years to kind of deal with that. And last year released her first solo album on Rounder. Again, the focus is all on the music here. She's making it the way she wants to. And her voice comes through. And this woman can flat sing. That's the Hat Guy Do Hat Guys singing with her, Alan Jackson.
Jeannie Kendall and Alan Jackson. This young sizing that you speak of in the music industry, is it having the same effect as it has in, you know, other parts of the workforce where young people look around and say, you know what, I don't want to be like so, you know, fill in the blank,
yeah,
who just got laid off.
Right.
You know, is it encouraging people to leave mainstream labels?
More than that, Robin, I think it's encouraging them to not even contemplate major label careers. And you're right, it's exactly the same as is happening throughout corporate America today. The line I hear from young musicians today the most in explaining why they don't want to go the major label route at all, is I want to do this my whole life. So more and more artists are wanting to go what they increasingly are calling the Ani DiFranco route, mm-hmm. of being able to own their own career from the beginning. I'll give you a great example of it. A Massachusetts songwriter named Mark Arelli, maybe the most purely talented songwriter I've seen on the scene in years, but he's all over the map stylistically. You know, he'll do some country, some honky-tonk, some western swing, some blues, some urban songwriting. So it's hard to draw a bead on his own personality. And I think the reason for that is that he's building a career for himself on a little Massachusetts indie label called Signature Sounds that doesn't even contemplate intersection with the mainstream. So his latest album, Hillbilly Pilgrim, is number 6 on the Billboard Americana charts, which isn't bad for a little company like Signature Sounds. And here in this cut, you can really hear how he fuses his love of traditional American roots music with very hip urban songwriting.
It's just a bend in the river where the water slows down. It might not look like much to you, but it's my hometown. There ain't no mystery how this town was born. It started with a couple farms, then the mill and the general store.
So given this, given that sort of, you know, indies used to be farm teams for majors, and now it's the other way around, I think I hear you saying, who are the career models for young stars today? Who, you know, who do they want to be wannabes of?
I think more than anybody else, the person I hear about is Alison Krauss. Here's a woman.
All roads lead to Alison Krauss.
They really do. And what a career she's having. She won 3 Grammys this year. So at the age of 33, she's now the female artist with the most Grammy wins in history, beating out Aretha Franklin for it. Both of the songs she sang on the soundtrack to Cold Mountain were nominated for Oscars this year. And she's always been with Rounder Records since she was 15 years old. She has an almost family-like relationship with them. And here she is from a Sugar Hill All-Star tribute to Dolly Parton, paying homage to a singer and songwriter that influenced her in a big way. And this is the theme to the hit movie 9 to 5, topical song for today.
They let you dream just to watch them shatter. You're just a step on the boss man's ladder, but you got dreams he'll never take away. You're in the same boat with a lot of your friends, waiting for the day.
Now, folk critic Scott Alaric. Scott, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Mom.
And for a list of the musicians Scott's been telling us about, go to our website, here-now.org. And this note, last night the hit HBO show Sex and the City ended its 6-year run, mourned by millions of fans who identified with the 4, 20, then 30-something stars. Then there were those of us who loved the show as one would a National Geographic special. The Fab Four were that foreign to us. Who has time for so many dates or so many lunches to talk about your dates? Who can afford $40,000 worth of shoes? And what kind of people were these? Except for Miranda, whose mom died, no one seemed to have any relatives, with all the wackiness they bring to the table. No one ever gained weight. But last night, they all gained gravitas. Carrie reunited with her former boyfriend, Mr. Big, who, we learn, is named John. They might actually have to make it work this time or explore a serious judgment problem on her part. Samantha battles cancer, loses her libido, but gains true emotional feelings. Charlotte and her husband Harry receive news they'll be adopting. And Miranda finds her mother-in-law slipping into dementia, rooting through the trash, and gives her a lovely bath. Who knew the breast seen on the last Sex and the City would belong to a grandmother? A critic in today's Boston Globe was disappointed. The Sex and the City stars seem to have stumbled onto a completely different show, she writes. I disagree. I say, too bad it's ending just when their lives were actually getting interesting.
And so peaceful until you fall in love. Simple, the sky up above. Simple is caving in. Wow! Never be so nuts about a guy you wanna love. You wanna cry, you crush your heart and hope to die. Till it's over. And
Here and Now is a production of WVOR Boston. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.